protecting our shorelines and our cities from sea level rise. Good morning, and thanks for joining us this Monday. Hope you had a nice weekend. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, how and why the beaches and those mayors out of the beaches are making coastal resiliency a top priority. What are your questions about this? Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, First Coast author Troy Mosley marks Black History Month with his new thoughts and reflections about what's going on in the military. Plus, Cole Pepper with all the highlights from last night's big game. Did you watch? Maybe not. All of that ahead this morning. But first, this hour, mayors at the beaches are taking the lead on coastal resiliency. In particular, the city of Atlantic Beach is working proactively to address sea level rise and climate change by developing a coastal vulnerability assessment and adaption plan. This news comes as Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry says he's joining with the beaches mayors to form a committee on sea level rise for the region. That's a change for Mayor Curry. In the past, he cheered, for example, President Trump's decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord agreements. There's a lot to discuss here. What does this mean for our region? How is this new linking of arms in local leadership going to make a positive difference? We decided to find out, so we invited Mayor Ellen Glasser, the mayor of Atlantic Beach, to join us now with more. Mayor Glasser, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And what are your questions about the new Committee on Sea Level Rise for the First Coast and efforts at the beaches to really address the issue of coastal vulnerability? Give us a call right now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We're already getting your tweets. Send yours to @MelissaInJax. And we welcome your comments on Facebook as well. All right. In a moment, Mayor, we'll talk about the effort across municipalities that's happening. But first, I wanted to ask you about what's happening at the Atlantic Beach City Commission. You had a priority setting session on January 9th, and you identified coastal resiliency as being one of the biggest priorities for your community. For the city of Atlantic Beach, you're developing a coastal vulnerability assessment and adaptation plan. Can you tell us what that plan might look like and why you decided to put this at the top of your agenda?
Well, I just want to say that I'm really happy as the mayor to add my voice to this important conversation. And along with my partner beach mayors, there's a lot of synergy going on in terms of this discussion. So it's not just Atlantic Beach. But our commission has been looking at property acquisitions, and so we started looking at some of the modeling of what the impact of sea level rise was going to be. And we found that pretty scary, actually. And so we started looking at what we could be doing more in the area of coastal resiliency. So through our planning staff, we've applied for this grant in order to do the vulnerability assessment and develop this adaptation plan. We should have that prepared for us by June. And so we decided that we wanted to make our voice heard. And as members of the beaches, that we wanted to partner with Mayor Curry to be much more proactive in this area. Although sea level rise is a real thing. I mean, the numbers are undeniable.
Absolutely. According to the latest projections from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Florida coast is looking at another 8 to 10 inches of sea level rise in the next decade or two, that there could be more inches. We don't really know exactly, but it is certainly the overwhelming scientific consensus that we will experience sea level rise. And you mentioned Mayor Curry. He came out to the beaches and made an announcement with you, Mayor Elaine Brown of Neptune Beach, the Jacksonville Beach Mayor, all of you speaking with one voice at the announcement of a beach renourishment project in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma, that there's going to be an ad hoc committee on sea level rise for this entire metropolitan area. I think that's welcome news for so many residents who feel that Jacksonville has lagged behind other major Florida cities in looking at this issue proactively. What are you hoping to see happen with this committee?
Well, I think the important thing is to really start talking about this. As policymakers, we have to do more to mitigate the impacts of flooding, tidal issues, storm surge. It's going to affect other industries, though. I mean, this is going to become a much bigger issue than just government. We're looking at how developers are going to respond, how the insurance industry is going to respond. And you're right. This is not a new problem for Florida. Florida is the most vulnerable of all our states in terms of flooding and sea level rise. We've seen the issues that St. Augustine has. So again, we feel like at the beach, the three beach mayors, that we can be on the front line of this and start to get the conversation going in a very big way with the city of Jacksonville.
You've received this grant from the state, the Florida Resilient Coastlines Program, $40,000 to help you deal with the effects of flooding, erosion, habitat shifts. You'll be able now to hire a consultant to analyze threats posed by sea level rise and look at resiliency measures. As coastal cities all over the country and the world look at this, they're trying to figure out, well, what's the timeline? Where are our most vulnerable points? How are we going to protect homes, businesses, protect our tourism economy? This is a serious economic threat that we're looking at. And, you know, the timeline is not tomorrow, which I think is why maybe it's been difficult for people to plan. But it's gratifying to see that the planning is getting more serious now. As mayor, what concerns you the most about the vulnerabilities in Atlantic Beach? When you look at homes, businesses, tourism, what keeps you up at night? What are you most concerned about?
Well, again, we look at the models for what the increases from sea level rise are going to be. And they paint a pretty frightening scenario. You talk about the number of inches that we expect to see with the rise in the next 20 years. But inches quickly turn into feet.
Yeah.
And we're talking about really our lifetimes and the lifetimes of our kids. I mean, we want to leave the beach in a better way for our kids. So sea level rise is a thing. We just have to manage it. And we manage it through mitigation. We manage it through new building regulations. We manage it with beach renourishment. I mean, we have a lot of tools in the toolkit for this. But at the end of the day, what keeps me awake is what it's going to look like for my kids.
Right.
I mean, there are some projections that we could see a 6-foot rise in sea level within the next 100 years. That's not that far away.
Let's go to your calls now for Mayor Ellen Glasser. Atlantic Beach's mayor, along with all of the other beaches' mayors, are working together now on this issue of sea level rise and coastal resiliency. Do you live at the coast or inland? What are your questions and thoughts about this? Already getting your tweets. We'll go to those in a moment. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Mylan is in Ponte Vedra Beach. Mylan, good morning.
Yes, hi. Good morning, all. Yeah, I think the conversation really has to be about, CO2 reduction rather than, spending resources, time and taxpayer dollars on fortification. Mother Nature is going to do what it's going to do. You know, this is a huge country. You know, we have to move inland. But I think the conversation has to be, CO2 reduction, rather than, spending resources on this, That's my point.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that. Okay. So what about that question? You know, Mayor, when you were out at the beach the other day with the other mayors, you announced a beach renourishment project. What about his point that we can keep putting sand back on the beach over and over and over again, but at a certain point, is that just throwing good money after bad? You know, are we wasting our money doing that? Would we be better served taking a more holistic approach to this in terms of reducing, putting our priority, our emphasis on reducing CO2 emissions and educating the public about that?
Well, I appreciate the caller's concern, but I will say that experts do point to mitigation strategies as something we can be doing right now. I mean, is it realistic to expect everyone at the beach to move inland? I don't think that's a realistic option right now. Maybe as the conversation progresses, that will become what we talk about. But we are not near ready for that. In the meantime, the beach renourishment, is the result of, you know, we've had several big storms in the last few years. We are seeing more and bigger storms these days. So I understand the issue, but those renourishment efforts benefit our entire community, not just the oceanfront property owners, but it's our cities, it's the Barrier Island, and it's all of Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you about the announcement when you talked about the beach renourishment effort. Both you and the other two mayors at the beaches endorsed Mayor Curry for re-election. At this press event, he announced the formation of a new ad hoc committee on sea level rise that Jacksonville City Hall will be getting engaged in, which was certainly welcome news for anyone who's followed this issue closely. Here's a tweet, though, from a listener. Louise tweets the show, "Why is Mayor Glasser supporting a mayor who doesn't believe in global warming and clapped when Trump pulled the U.S. from the Paris Agreement?" Certainly, Mayor Curry has come in for criticism on his stance on this in the past. He did applaud the president's decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Accords, which were struck in 2015. The U.S. now the only developed nation on Earth that isn't part of those accords. So is Mayor Curry, talking out of both sides of his mouth when on the one hand he's saying let's address sea level rise, but on the other hand he's applauding the president's decision to withdraw from Paris, which was a worldwide effort to get at the root causes of what's causing affecting our changing climate?
Well, that's a big question. I would like to just respond by saying I'm a small town mayor and I'm taking care of the 14,000 people that live in Atlantic Beach. And I'm using my voice to try to advance our causes, our needs. When we had the storm, Hurricane Irma in 2017, and our dunes were decimated, in fact, in the North Atlantic Beach, they were gone. Mayor Curry and his staff made sure that we were going to get a renourishment effort. Again, that protects our whole city. So I'm responding to the needs of my constituents, and I'm not looking backward. I'm looking forward in terms of what we can do together. I see myself on the front line with this, and Mayor Curry responded when we asked for help, and we appreciated that.
Let's go back to that. What are your most vivid memories of, as an executive, a city leader, dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Irma?
Well, first of all, it's mostly about life, and we didn't suffer the loss of life that other communities have suffered, and so I'm extremely grateful for that. And then you start to look at property damage and people whose houses were damaged by the storm. And then my neighbors whose dunes were completely gone as a result, leaving them and our community exposed. So, you know, my reaction is I think that we were fortunate that we weren't hit worse than we were, mm-hmm. although the city of Jacksonville suffered flooding like we hadn't seen before. But in Atlantic Beach, I think that we were very fortunate to not have much worse damage.
It could have been so much worse. And it's funny because when I think back on it, too, everybody was so worried about the beaches communities. And what took everyone by surprise, I think, across this whole region was how the storm surge affected our downtown historic neighborhoods, the neighborhoods that hug the river. I think it was just such a reminder of how unpredictable severe weather can be. We have to plan for the unexpected, which is, I think, driving your decision on this.
Well, and you're right. That was shocking to see the downtown flooded like that. And so I do think that elevates this issue to be something that we need to come together on. And we're not there yet. We're just starting this conversation. And I come from a place of working together and partnership. And I'm going to maintain that kind of posture as we move forward. And again, we're on the front lines and we want to work with Mayor Curry and the city of Jacksonville to have a better plan.
You know, think about the fact too that so much of our economy is here in Florida is driven by tourism, people wanting to come to our beautiful beaches. At a certain point, that leg of our economic stool is not going to be quite so viable if we don't have beaches anymore. You know, if the water has come in to such a degree that we have managed retreat from the coastlines and no beaches really to speak of, or at least in the way that we've known them traditionally for so many years. And I know when we talk about this, people think, well, that's crazy. But when you look at the climate models, in the year, say, 2030, 2040, and 2050, if nothing is done to aggressively reduce emissions around the world, we're looking at a worst-case scenario where something like, I think it was 30-35% of this region will be underwater by the year 2050. That's within many of our lifetimes and certainly within our children's lifetimes, you know.
Well, let me just say, we have time. Our beaches are still beautiful. Please come visit our beaches. Yeah. They're among the greatest in the state. So your point is well taken. We need to start working on this issue. We need to use our voices to talk about the problems that we're facing. And we need to avail ourselves of all the mitigation strategies, such as dune renourishment, that are available to us. Because it is about the quality of life that we have here in our community. And we're working hard to preserve that.
And it's 549-2937 to join us as we speak with Atlantic Beach Mayor Ellen Glasser about coastal resiliency on the First Coast. Okay, so you've been awarded this $40,000 grant from the DEP, the Department of Environmental Protection. And you're hoping to have a plan, I guess, by June of this summer, kind of outlining what the resiliency measures will be for Atlantic Beach. What are you hearing from constituents when you craft this plan? What do you think is most important to them?
Well, we haven't gotten a lot of feedback yet. I mean, just because this is still all very new. I mean, what you've talked about today is all just now starting to emerge in Atlantic Beach. But we will be looking at mitigation strategies. We'll be looking at ways that we can address our stormwater management plan. I mean, we're going to have to spend some money to upgrade our infrastructure so that water drains where it's supposed to go. We are going to be looking at additional conversions from septic to sewer. We're going to be looking at water quality. We're going to be looking at enhancing our tree canopy in Atlantic Beach. We love our trees, but trees actually help to absorb stormwater. Mm-hmm. So this is a part of a holistic plan. I'm not really sure what to expect when we see this. We are installing walkovers, which are at our beach access points, which are ways of hardening up the shoreline. I mean, there's a multitude of ways that we can mitigate the water issues in our community. In terms of how do we adapt, I mean, I think we'll probably see changes in building regulations. Maybe the footprints of homes needs to be higher moving forward. Maybe some areas will need to be on stilts. I mean, there are a lot of things that I look forward to learning about and sharing with our community.
Right. You just went through a really comprehensive list of all of the changes that you're looking at. And I think when we talk about resiliency, you just explain why this is so complicated. It's sort of this interlocking series of changes and strategies that coastal communities are having to adopt or at least study. You mentioned stormwater. You know, just the other day we had on the mayor of St. Augustine, Nancy Shaver, and that is a big priority for the nation's oldest city, too, that she's looking at. People don't stop and think about the fact always that if our water supply gets polluted due to rising sea levels, then there's sort of this cascading effect, this parade of horribles that will make an area basically unlivable if we don't manage it correctly. These are the types of infrastructure things that aren't obvious to everyone, but they're so important, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And Mayor Shaver has really taken a leadership role in this. I'm going to say in Atlantic Beach, our issues are not as dire as they are in St. Augustine. I mean, their wastewater treatment plant is threatened because it has very low elevation. We don't have that problem. So they are looking at sunny day tidal flooding on a regular basis. And so their issues are much more emergent than ours are. We're going to be looking at what they do. And I know we're going to be working with Mayor Shaver as we move forward. The beaches are going to host a symposium this spring to bring in experts and, again, to really start to talk about this in the public square and use our voices to talk about where do we go from here.
Tell us a little bit more about this symposium and how people can be part of it, if you could.
Well, it's a little early to say, but I do want to give a shout out to my fellow beach mayors. That's Mayor Elaine Brown in Neptune Beach and Charlie Latham in Jacksonville Beach. And we really do want to speak with one voice. And so Neptune Beach is going to take the lead on this symposium. And hopefully we look to do this in about in the April timeframe, and more details will be available later.
Excellent. We will definitely follow up on that. And also, I'll make mention again of something we mentioned on the show just a week or two ago. In May, St. Augustine will be hosting the Keeping History Above Water National Conference, looking at how to preserve St. Augustine's historic district and monuments from rising waters. This is a really important national event with some renowned speakers and subject matter experts coming in. So I would encourage you to mark your calendar for that. And if you're just tuning in, we're going to take a few more calls for Atlantic Beach Mayor Ellen Glasser as she joins with the mayor of Jacksonville Beach, Charlie Latham, the mayor of Neptune Beach, Elaine Brown, and Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry, looking at the issues of coastal resiliency and sea level rise. Atlantic Beach has won a $40,000 grant from the state to analyze threats posed by the impacts of sea level rise and to figure out how they can become a more resilient city. Let's take just one more call. It's 549-2937. David is on the south side. Hey, David, good morning. How are you today?
Hey, good morning, Melissa. I hear this is great news that we've got the Beaches mayor stepping forward to respond to this issue. I commend them for their bravery. I would, as part of the plan, I would encourage them to start looking at developing a carbon emission inventory for their communities to help educate folks on the cause of the problem and to help lay the groundwork for our Mayor Curry and our state and even our national leaders now to understand they just can't assume that the Chinese are going to solve our greenhouse gas problem for us, that we've got to lead by example here in the United States and create good jobs locally by addressing the root cause of sea level rise and more intense storms. That's my comment.
Okay, thanks for that. What about that, Mayor Glasser, an inventory? The municipalities should be inventorying their carbon emissions.
Well, I'm so glad that he asked that question because I might have forgotten to mention that Atlantic Beach is seeking to be the first certified city in Florida under the LEED for Cities program. That's Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. As part of that application process, we looked at 14 different metrics in terms of what are we doing in Atlantic Beach. And the very first one is energy and greenhouse gas emissions. So we have applied for a silver status to be a LEED city in Florida, and that's through our Environmental Stewardship Committee that's working hard. It's a volunteer group of people in Atlantic Beach to take on these issues. So we're just starting on this, but I appreciate your concern, sir.
And we're getting lots of emails for you as well, Mayor Glasser. Here's one from Kenneth. Based on the resiliency conversation, I'm hearing mitigation to the physical environment, but what about the social aspect? What about climate justice for those that don't have the economic capabilities to mitigate? People around the world, poorer people are going to be impacted the most by this. So what about, I don't know if that's something that's part of the study you're doing, but what about that question?
Well, to be honest, I don't know if it's a part of the study that we're doing, but I hear the caller. I want to take a look at that. I mean, I've seen the impact on major hurricanes on people who are economically challenged. We saw that in Katrina in a prior life. I responded after that storm and I saw it firsthand and it touches my heart. And so I'm making a note and I'm going to follow up on that.
Okay, here's another email from Ira. Nature is telling coastal Florida to back off. Beach renourishment is code for wealthy coastal residents getting federal and state welfare. This is not a new problem. Give nature back to nature and move west of St. John's. Okay, so this is a listener saying, look, we can renourish the beaches, we can do certain aspects, but in the end, we're going to have to pull back from the coasts. Do you agree?
Well, I'm really not going to respond in the manner that I think it's time to retreat. I mean, I think we have time to work this problem. I would say that the beaches are public. They are for everyone, and they protect our city. It's not just a matter of protecting the people that live on the ocean. They protect everyone in my city. And so I'm not ready to say, let's retreat. I'm not even sure what that would look like at this point. I think it's more important to start talking And that's what I have to say about that.
And we are glad that you talked to us. So thank you so much for appearing on the show. She's Mayor Ellen Glasser, the mayor of Atlantic Beach. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, Culpepper on last night's Super Bowl. But up next, marking Black History Month with local author Troy Mosley. This is First Coast Connect. Keep listening.
WJCT's new podcast tells the stories of local people.
You have one of your soldiers laying there, and you have the person that is trying to kill your soldiers on the opposite side.
It wasn't so much that I felt guilty. I felt like it was impossible for him to love me.
I wasn't born with a crack pipe in my mouth. Thank you, Jesus. I'm not going to die with one.
What It's Like is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Well, a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court ruled to stay an injunction that would have blocked the Trump administration's policy on transgender armed forces members. Effectively, military service members who are already openly transgender can stay in the service, but those who are closeted must remain so or risk expulsion. Not only that, no new transgender members can join up unless the courts eventually overturn the policy. Now, Trump's transgender military ban has reignited debate about how this country handles diversity and social justice issues when it comes to those who serve in uniform. This has been a long-running problem and issue America has grappled with. February is Black History Month, of course, and one local author has written about the military's long and tortured history of integrating and becoming more inclusive. He has some thoughts about this, so we're pleased to welcome Troy Mosley, the author of Unwritten Truths, The Armed Forces and American Social Justice. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. You're a 20-year veteran, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. You grew up in Jacksonville Beach, went to Fletcher, Florida State, and also earned your commission through FAMU. So you really know what you're talking about when it comes to this issue. Before we get to the book, let me ask you your reaction first off about the Trump administration's new ruling on transgender troops. As someone who served, what do you think?
You know, I think that it is a step backwards. The previous administration under President Obama studied the issue quite extensively, and they used data from seven other of our allies who have a transgender policy that allows transgender members to serve in the armed forces. And based on those comprehensive studies and the Department of Defense's own analysis, they rolled out a plan that was in keeping with the DOD values of inclusion. And I think it's very unfortunate that we're now having a reverse until the courts can decide on its legality.
This is history not repeating but rhyming, I guess, because in your book, Unwritten Truths, you talk about just the long arc of this, that underrepresented segments of our society are all, over the years, just asking to be treated with fairness and to get the same opportunities. This is something we can look at through the military, beginning with the desegregation of the armed forces in 1948. You write about this in the book. Tell me a little bit more about your research and what you uncovered as you decided to pursue this story and this study.
You're so correct, Melissa. What I found in general is there's at least one main thread that connects all underrepresented segments of our society, and that is the struggle to self-determine and to be the best expressions of themselves as all Americans enjoy who are considered mainstream, quote unquote. So in my research, I found that we've had members from all ethnicities. We've had women, we've had gay and lesbian members that have made significant contributions, who have served with valor and distinction. And so ultimately, if you do an assessment, you see that competence and a willingness to serve is are the key components to determining who should and should not be able to serve.
Let's go to a few calls now. It is Black History Month as we speak with author Troy Mosley about his book, Unwritten Truths, 549-2937. Keith is in Riverside. Hi, Keith. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, Troy. I want to commend you on your excellent book, which I've read and posted a review of on Amazon. I could not agree with you more about what you're saying. There is a regression occurring, at least in my opinion, and based on the information I've gathered from reluctantly gathered from the military. And I think it's real important that we begin to speak up about these issues, because we need to nip this in the bud. We're going to be talking about diversity issues, diversity in the Navy following the Vietnam War era at Jacksonville University on the 11th. And I'd like to invite all veterans, regardless of service, to come out and attend that and possibly share their stories.
Tell us a little bit more about that, Keith.
Well, I wrote a book called Black Officer, White Navy, and JU graciously decided to put up a forum for myself and Captain Glenn Leverett to discuss the progress and possibly lack thereof in the Navy following the Vietnam War. It looks like there might be several retired flag officers there. I'm getting lots of interest and also lots of concerns. I've gotten text messages at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning from active duty people who are experiencing problems. Both the Navy and the Coast Guard are having some issues. If you just look around on the internet a little bit, you'll see what I'm talking about.
Well, what do you mean? Like issues with discrimination or harassment, that kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely. There was a black female lieutenant commander in the Coast Guard who recently had her case made national news. She was being sexually harassed and retaliated against. And the Coast Guard IG came down hard on them, the leadership of the Coast Guard Academy. And then the Navy just recently had a case where the Chief of Naval Operations was chastised because of his handling of a sexual harassment complaint. Now, those attitudes, when your leadership can't handle, follow the proper procedures and protect their people, well, what do you think's happening in the lower ranks? That's some of the stuff that we'll be talking about at JU.
And that's coming up on the 11th, right?
On the 11th of February at 7 p.m. And Troy, once again, I cannot commend you enough for the fine work that you did in your book. We cover a lot of the same ground in our book, and you are a bit more diplomatic than I am about some of the problems. But I think it's a wonderful book, and I encourage everyone to read it.
Thank you, Keith. That's Keith Green, another local veteran who's written a great book. His is called Black Officer, White Navy. Thanks, Keith.
Melissa,
He's been on the show as well. Yeah.
Can I just comment very quickly? Thank you, Keith, for that endorsement. And I agree with you in that we are living in a historical moment. We are at a time in the midst of reshaping the conversation of what it means to be American. And there are at least two opposing views that are competing for center stage, one which values diversity and inclusion and one which does not. I'm not sure if you were aware, but on last Sunday's Meet the Press, famed journalist Tom Brokaw was very candid in sharing his observations on certain segments of our society not doing enough to assimilate.
Didn't he say people, Hispanic immigrants, need to learn to speak English more quickly, I think is what he was criticized for saying.
That is exactly what he said, Melissa. And he also went on to say that when he pushed his more conservative friends and people in his circle, they would ultimately admit that, quite frankly, they're not sure if they want brown grandbabies. Now, that in and of itself is everyone's right to choose what they want. But I think we should be able to discuss this and have conversations about why people feel that way. And I think if we do so, we will find that we all really strive for the same things: to be loved, to be nurtured, to be cared for, to be valued. And those are the things that leadership help a society to go forward and grow. And we see that in the best traditions of leaders like Kennedy, like King.
And the military has always been the laboratory for how this country moves forward on these issues. You know, Truman desegregated the military in 1948, years before the Civil Rights Act was signed into law. The military's always been the leading indicator. You know, as I mentioned, you're a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, a 20-year veteran. You served honorably in a number of capacities, including in the Middle East, where I believe during Operation Iraqi Freedom, you set up a whole military hospital. Isn't that right?
Yes, that is correct.
And so as an African-American officer, you likely saved many, many lives, and your talents were vital. You would not have been allowed to serve if you had been born in an earlier era. You know, and as we talk about all of this, at the same time we talk about the military, there are all kinds of flare-ups happening all over the country right now. Just a few weeks ago, there was this standoff between a Native American and the boys of Covington Catholic High School in Northern Kentucky, and that laid bare this country's divides over ideology, politics, race. This morning, the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, is refusing to step down, even though members of his own party, the Democratic Party, are insisting he step down after these photos of him emerged from his old medical school yearbook, appearing to be in blackface with another student standing next to him wearing a KKK costume. And so, you know, whether it's in the military or in the political sphere, as a country, as you said, Troy, we are looking at a divide in this country where we are going to either embrace inclusion more forcefully, or we're seeing at the same time sort of a backlash from that whole priority. I think that's why I think your book is so very timely right now.
I could not agree more, Melissa. I'd like to read an excerpt of from the book, if I may.
Sure.
And this is from chapter 7 on remaining challenges. Americans, regardless of race, religion, gender, nationality, and sexual orientation, must not only be free to defend this country and the Constitution, but they must be made to feel that their contributions to this nation are valued. If America is to once and for all overcome the ills of racism, sexism, and homophobia, its institutions, policies, and elected officials must denounce injustice unequivocally at every opportunity. Looking back, we can all see the immorality and divisive ideologies. Hindsight is 20/20 because it is unencumbered by the rose-colored lenses of agenda. Americans must challenge ourselves to keep the spectacles of agenda off when looking at present and future challenges. Doing so will require great courage and faith in our institutions, our system of governance, and our citizenry. It is this faith that gives us the courage to take principled stances. As the premier leadership institution in the world, the United States military must promulgate these values of freedom and equality of opportunity for all and continue to lead through the examples of a storied and diverse history of inclusion and excellence.
Thanks for that. And thanks for sharing your book with us. He's author Troy Mosley, and it's Unwritten Truths, The Armed Forces and American Social Justice. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
In a moment, Culpepper on last night's big game. We'll be right back.
Comcast Business, providing a gig speed network that gets business done. Comcast Business, beyond fast. More at comcastbusiness.com.
I'm David Luckin, inviting you to listen to the Electro Lounge for the best down-tempo and new jazz at 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday nights, only on 89.9 FM, WJCT. Sports Wrap Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Well, last night's Super Bowl was historic in more ways than one.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
All right, Cole Pepper, the lowest scoring Super Bowl in history, is that right?
13-3.
Wow.
Not exactly the kind of game you would expect out of the two of the top four highest scoring teams in the league this year, but this is what we had, and it is historic as well for the Patriots head coach Bill Belichick and quarterback Tom Brady, who each won their sixth Super Bowl rings. It's a record for both a coach and for a quarterback. No other player had ever won six rings. Tom Brady had five previous, as did Charles Haley, who played for the Cowboys and 49ers. Now Brady stands alone with six. I don't think that I would call the game riveting.
No, not at all.
There really weren't any big major moments, certainly. The Rams punted more times in the first half than they had in any game all year long. And that was just the first half. When you go 3-3 at halftime, it was 3-3 going into the fourth quarter. So just the one touchdown scored by Sony Michel, the former Georgia Bulldog. I guess the Jaguars can take some solace in the fact that they beat the Super Bowl champions during the year, although that seems like an awful long time ago.
Yeah, it does.
That the Jaguars dominated the Patriots in week two of the season. That was the game. There, as always, a lot of business that gets taken care of Super Bowl week in the National Football League. One of those things that was taken care of is the Hall of Fame voting, and for the third straight year, former Jaguars left tackle Tony Boselli was a finalist for the Hall of Fame, but for the third straight year, he did not make it into the final
five.
That's
too bad.
Yeah, and they don't officially announce this, but we do get reports from inside the room, and it appears that Boselli was very close for the second straight year. Of the 15, he made the cut to 10, but not the cut to 5. I think at some point he's going to get in. Maybe it's next year, and I want to size up a little bit of what could happen next year. There is only one, what I would call slam dunk, surefire, first ballot Hall of Famer who's becoming eligible next year. That's Troy Polamalu of the Pittsburgh Steelers. There are some very good players as well, like the Colts receiver Reggie Wayne, 49ers linebacker Patrick Willis, but I don't think they're going to be first ballot type of players. I don't think they're transcendent players. So let's say Polamalu makes it in. That would leave four spots. You can only have five go in any one year. Among the others to make the cut to 10 with Boselli are a safety, Steve Atwater of the Broncos, guards Alan Faneca and Steve Hutchinson, and running back Edgerrin James. So three offensive linemen likely to be finalists again next year. This year we did see one Kevin Mawai, the former Titans and Jets center, go in. So it'll be interesting to see if the selectors would choose multiple offensive linemen to go in. We'll see how it all plays out. I think if Boselli had played one more full season, he'd already be in.
He'd already be in.
Just questions about the length of his career. And if he'd played in a bigger market, he'd probably also be in.
That's a good point, too. And in a moment, we'll talk about the rest of last night's big game. You know, the halftime show, the ads, what you liked, what you didn't like. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Activism that started on the field picks up speed off of it.
We're going to press forward with our efforts in supporting organizations who impact change in our communities and our society.
At the end of another NFL season, Seattle Seahawks wide receiver Doug Baldwin talks about the future of protest and the fight for social justice. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
The news business, emphasis on business, has had a rough go lately. The decline of print, the rise of Facebook, and politics, too.
And, you know, a Times journalist I saw recently admitted to me that when he's not writing about Trump and Trump isn't in his headline, he doesn't get the traffic.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, trying to keep your principles while you're making a profit. Next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
The book before his time, The Untold Story of Harry T. Moore, America's First Civil Rights Martyr, is being published in a new edition with updated material. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with author Ben Green. We'll discuss Florida Highways Magazine and automobility in the Jim Crow era. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
The new Green Deal, America's best new idea?
This is going to be the moonshot, the civil rights movement of our generation.
Or a prescription for poverty.
Green New Deal, sorry, no more driving for you. You are taking the bus.
How the new politics of climate change is shaping up and squaring off. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Okay, we talked about the big game last night, but now Cole is going to stick around and talk about the other half of the show, the ads and the Maroon 5 performance. Okay, Cole, what ads stuck out for you last night at the Super Bowl?
For me, and this may have been influenced by the fact that I'm a Game of Thrones fan. I thought the Bud Light Game of Thrones commercial was a terrific one. I love a twist in a commercial, and anticipating the final season of that HBO series, I thought it came off terrific. Yeah,
yeah, that one did get a lot of plaudits. Let's take a listen to it.
It's a beautiful day for a joust.
Indeed. Sun's out. Got my lucky loincloth, cold Bud Light, comfy throne. I don't have the plague anymore.
Look, it's the Bud Knight.
Dilly dilly!
All right, let's tap this keg. Giddy up, Peanut!
Okay, you kind of had to imagine that last half, but
right.
Picture Game of Thrones imagery.
Yeah, with the mountain from Game of Thrones winning the joust and then crushing the Bud Knight's head, and then here came the dragon in to torch the whole place.
Yeah.
As you're watching, you thought, oh, here's another Bud Light commercial. Okay, dilly dilly, we've been through the. Oh, here
sure.
we go.
Had a surprise.
I thought it was a fun twist. I would love to hear the story of how that came to be, because those are the same actors who have played in many of those dilly dilly based Bud Light medieval ads. To see how that sort of crossover came, I thought that was well played.
Let's listen to a more serious one. This is the Washington Post defending a free press.
When we go off to war, when we exercise our rights, when we soar to our greatest heights, when we mourn and pray, when our neighbors are at risk, when our nation is threatened, there's someone to gather the facts. To bring you the story, no matter the cost. Because knowing empowers us. Knowing helps us decide. Knowing keeps us free.
Tom Hanks doing the narration.
Yeah, and a guy who played Ben Bradley, the
editor of the Washington Post
in the film. And That's probably the most, for me, it was the most compelling conversation spot that was run during the Super Bowl. Obviously, I think you'll have a pretty divided reaction to that based on probably party lines in some regard. But anybody who has worked in journalism and understands the value of the free press probably should have responded fairly dramatically to that.
Right. And let's also talk about the halftime show. Adam Levine, Maroon 5, Travis Scott, even SpongeBob SquarePants made an appearance. But let me ask you about the hashtag that trended last night, I'm with Cap. Celebrities, particularly African-American ones, saying they were not going to watch the Super Bowl in support of Colin Kaepernick, who ignited the Take a Knee movement that spread throughout the NFL to protest racial injustice. We also saw big stars like Rihanna and Cardi B saying they wouldn't play the Super Bowl, although Cardi B did appear in an ad.
Hmm. Does that make you wonder about the motivations for Cardi B? I don't know. Obviously, the Take a Knee storyline, which is now roughly 2 years old, if you talk about the full seasons where the league wide where this has been happening, longer than that with Kaepernick himself, is still an issue. Kaepernick did tweet out during the day a couple of things that to let everybody know he's still there and involved with the activism. I still have a huge question as far as Kaepernick, and this is as a sports guy. I don't know if he wants to play at this point. He's making $1 million from Nike alone just as a spokesman. So you can either make $1 million plus whatever else you're making and still have that platform, or you can risk getting your head beat in by defensive ends 16 weeks a year.
He's moved beyond that, it seems.
I think so. But there are still a lot of fans who wonder why doesn't this X team or Y team pick up Colin Kaepernick, because he'd be better than what they have right now. Some of those are Jaguars fans who would say, hey, Kaepernick's got to be better than what the Jaguars have had at quarterback.
All right. Always good to get your insights. Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Catch him every night on our news partner, Channel 4 News for Jax, talking sports. Thanks, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
And 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.